very soon. Until then, Nagaj, or later.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakawut dao. We'll see you again.
This is Bird Note. In September, Arctic terns fly south over the ocean from Alaska all the way to Antarctica. Also in September, the last rufous hummingbirds depart their breeding range in the west, following floral highways of mountain wildflowers south to Mexico. Ruby-crowned kinglets are leaving the northern evergreen forests where they nest on their way to milder climates. Each of these birds is migrating, but on a very different course. All have the same adaptive goal, making the most of food and breeding opportunities that change with the seasons. Arctic terns follow one of the longest annual migrations, traveling as much as 44,000 miles each year. Arctic tundra provides their ideal nesting site in summer. The Antarctic, the ideal feeding grounds in our winter. Rufous hummingbirds are medium-range migrants, traversing about 5,000 miles a year between temperate and tropical nectar sources. Some ruby-crowned kinglets are altitudinal migrants, especially in the west. They may remain close to the same latitude all year, but spend the cold months in the relative warmth of the lowlands, dining on insects and their eggs. In summer, you'll need to ascend thousands of feet into the western mountain ranges to hear the kinglet's exuberant song. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Hey, my name's Katie. You want some cool new music to listen to? Want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, come hang with me every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Raccoon City's where I'll be. Hope to see you there.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is a CKTZ News update. I'm Louis Belcourt.
Peter Rynch has stepped down from his position as CEO of Hollyhock.
As of July 2024,
Rynch was introduced to Hollyhock in 2007 through various programs at the Retreat Center, and he took on the leadership role in 2017. Rynch cites achievements he's proud of, including enhancing workplace culture and fostering reconciliation, but acknowledges ongoing issues such as improving staff wages and facility maintenance.
CKTZ reached out to Hollyhock for comment on next steps of their hiring process, but didn't receive a response.
Listen for more on the story.
My name is Peter Rynch. I am the outgoing CEO of Hollyhock. I've been in this role since August 1st, 2017, for 7 years to the day.
When did you first start getting involved at Hollyhock?
So I first came to Hollyhock in 2007 to a gathering called Social Change Institute. I was working in advocacy in the downtown east side, advocating for sex workers, drug users, and homeless people. And that was really my first experience with Hollyhock, 2007. I came back the following year for Art of Leadership, which was very transformational for me as a person, really helped me find my unique leadership voice. And then I came back for a gathering called Web of Change, which was focused on people using the internet to create change in the world. And so I was very aware of Hollyhock. I had recommended it to a lot of my friends. And so when the role of CEO became available, I started meeting with the team and applied for the role.
Why are you now stepping down as CEO? What led to that decision?
I never planned to stay for life. I think that before I had worked at Hollyhock, I worked in politics and advocacy, and I did start to notice that after about 5 to 7 years, I think it's really important for organizations to renew. And so I think for me, I always had in my mind 5 to 7 years. Of course, the challenge is the beautiful people that I worked with, the beautiful community that Cortez is. It's very hard to walk away from the people. And so I think that's why I ended up staying longer. And then, of course, COVID happened. So really, the reason I'm leaving is because I'm 49 years old and I'll be 50 next year. And this is the second time I've been a CEO. And I have come to this realization that at my stage of life, I'm much more interested in supporting leaders working in organizations than being the leader of an organization myself. I'm really glad that I took this role in 2017. It's been an honor of my life to work with the team here. And I strongly believe in the theory of change of these types of organizations. I think that the world is getting much more complex, much more frayed, much more challenging. And I think that the spaces that Hollyhock and other retreat centers offer are an antidote to that. But for me personally, it's time for me to go and support leaders running organizations and not be a person running an organization. And I think, as I said at the beginning, renewal is very important to me. And I think that organizations do best when they renew.
During your time at Hollyhock, what sort of change did you try to implement?
It's funny, I did not come in with a strong change mandate. I'd known Hollyhock, I'd been a participant, and I just thought, okay, I'll just go there and I'll work with the team. And as soon as I got here, I started to realize that Hollyhock was going through a generational transition, as many of these types of organizations are going through. And so what I would say is that the work that I did was to steward a change from one thing to another. And I'm not totally sure on what either side of those things were, but I think what feels really live for me is we really doubled down on the people and the culture of the organization. We worked really hard internally to create a culture of belonging so that staff felt invested in the organization, invested in the mission. So we did things like raised wages, increased and set up benefits packages, health benefits. We really created a culture of belonging inside the organization. And of course, it's not perfect. I'm very aware that's my story from my vantage point. There's probably a lot of people who think there's much more work to do, and I believe there is as well. But I think that I really worked hard to make this a place that felt very welcoming and very respectful to our staff community and to the island as best we could. That's one thing. The other thing that I feel really proud about is I think that we invested a lot in reconciliation and our relationship with the Clahoose here on Cortez. I think that one of the proudest moments of my life, one of the best experiences of my life is to have the Clahoose land their canoes on the beach in front of Hollyhock the first time since colonization. And that work is slow and it takes a lot of respect and a lot of trust. And I think that our team here at Hollyhock has done that work and continues to do that work and will continue to do that work. And so I think what I would say is that my tenure was marked by a lot of change, change of the organization. And really, I think that inevitably people attribute that change to an organizational leader. But for me, I really just happened to believe that I was in the right place at the right time and really allowed what wanted to emerge from this place emerge. And I think that is a paradigm of leadership that the world needs. And I think it creates wonderful things.
What change do you feel is still needed at Hollyhock?
I think that there's much more work to do on our wages, on our benefits, on making sure that people who work at Hollyhock can have a good life themselves. I think that organizations like Hollyhock get into trouble when they proclaim to be one thing, but the conditions on the ground are quite different. And so I think that if I was continuing to lead Hollyhock, I would continue to figure out ways to increase benefits and compensation for our staff. Hollyhock's been in existence for 42 years. So I think that there's a lot of maintenance that needs to happen on this facility, and that those dollars are always very hard to find. Some of the work over the years was we built out a campus plan, and there's a number of projects. We were really lucky to receive a federal grant 2 years ago to rebuild our hot tubs, which were at end of life. But there's a number of projects that need to get done. I think that the program mix, the programming that it does in the world, there's a lot of power in it, and it also needs constant renewal. And so I think this theme of renewal feels really live to me. At our last board meeting, I said that the organization has to put renewal at the center. It has to renew itself. It has to become meaningful to younger generations. All of these retreat centers face this challenge.
Anything else to add?
I also believe that in the 7 years that I've been running Hollyhock, we've built a number of partnerships across Cortez and through the community. And I think that we need to double down on that. I think that the idea or the time where tourists just came to Cortez, came to Hollyhock and left, it is over. And I think that we need to find ways to be in real reciprocal relationship and partnership with island social profits and island businesses. I think that Hollyhock thrives when Cortez thrives. And if Cortez is not thriving, it's very hard for Hollyhock to be successful.
Louis Bocor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island. CKTZ News is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, the program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
This is a CHY News Update. City of Nanaimo's outgoing poet laureate, Kamal Parmar, has been honored by becoming a new addition to the city's Poetry Walk. Located outside the Port Theatre, the Poetry Walk showcases the poetry of Nanaimo's past poet laureates. Parmar is the third poet to have their time as the literary ambassador honored in the Poetry Walk. CHY attended the unveiling of Parmar's stone outside the Port Theatre on August 29th. After the unveiling, CHY spoke with Parmar inside the theatre. She says while the 3 years in the position flew by, she was able to accomplish a lot. Projects she worked on included the Hidden Messages Poetry Project in 2022, where haikus she wrote were displayed outdoors on walkways using hydrophobic paint, appearing only when it rained. Another project that started in spring of this year was the Poetry in the Park Project, where people can walk around Bowen Park and find QR codes that link to poems Parmar wrote about the nature and the landscape of the park. With joining the Poetry Walk, Parmar says she's very proud to be honored.
I just never thought it'd be like this, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm a part of Nanaimo. I feel so happy and humbled, you know, that you guys have really done so much. I wish I could do more.
The Poetry Walk is along a busy sidewalk and across the street from the Nanaimo's waterfront walkway. Parmar says to those who will be out and see the Poetry Walk to not forget there's poetry in everyone.
Don't forget that there's poetry in all of us. I think each one of us is a poet. You just got to listen to your inner voice. I want people to just stand and look at the ocean, the breeze, the mountains. It's something which God, it's a painting. It's a painting come alive. I think Nanaimo is a painting come alive, you know. If you just sit and we could paint it with words.
She says people should go outside as nature is a special gift that should not be wasted. Jamie Brinsine is the Cultural Services Coordinator for the City of Nanaimo. She spoke to CHY about the unveiling. She says because the Poetry Walk is in such a busy part of the downtown area, it has highlighted the beauty of poetry to anyone walking by.
And so it's pretty special, first of all, because it's right out there where you're walking on the sidewalk, totally accessible at any time of day for someone to read these beautiful words by our poet laureates. And I think it's a very visible, a beautiful piece that reflects our appreciation of literary arts and poetry in Nanaimo. A very accessible way to read poetry as well. You know, it's right there where you're walking.
She says Parmar's efforts mean a lot to the community, and her being added to the Poetry Walk reflects the city's appreciation.
and also our appreciation of the Poet Laureate programs, because the Poet Laureates bring so much to the city and so much and offer so much to the community, and especially when it comes to engaging with poetry, which a lot of people can find quite intimidating. So
the City of Nanaimo is currently collecting submissions, seeking its next Poet Laureate. The deadline for submissions is Monday, September 16th at midnight. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you.
The Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival is back. Still Moon Arts Society is proud to announce the 22nd annual Renfrew Ravine Moon Festival. A fusion of art, nature, and community, this month-long festival celebrates the Harvest Moon, Still Creek, local art, and the diverse cultural traditions of the Renfrew Collingwood neighbourhood. Attendees can expect dazzling lanterns, live music, dance, food, art and nature workshops, and community performances, all including making salmon lanterns, mooncakes, and guided tours. Connect with the local nature as a community to raise awareness and bring positive change to restore Renfrew Ravine to its natural beauty. Learn more and register at stillmoonarts.ca.
In the absence of broadband internet in many rural areas, it's not uncommon for households to get their internet signal from farther afield, about 500 kilometers straight upward to be exact, from a satellite circling the planet in what's called near-Earth orbit. There are currently thousands of satellites owned and operated by Elon Musk's company Starlink in near-Earth orbit, and many other companies poised to start launching bigger and better satellites that would even provide cell service directly via satellite. The world is poised for a machine population explosion in near-Earth orbit, and while it has some people excited for truly global communications access, it has astronomers worried about the future of their science. Mount Allison's Catherine Lovkin is one of them. Lovkin recently wrote to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission to add her voice to those concerned for the future of astronomy as private satellite networks continue to proliferate unregulated and wreak havoc with the ability of scientists to observe the night sky. CHMA sat down with Lovkin to find out more. The astronomer says that according to the European Space Agency, there have been 18,400 satellites put into orbit since the first one in 1957, and that number is about to explode. Of the original number, about 12,000 are still up there, and almost 7,000 belong to satellite internet provider Starlink.
And the problem is not necessarily having satellite internet. It's the lack of regulation. So 7,000 Starlink satellites right now. The proposal is to have something like 40,000 to 50,000 total eventually. And Starlink is not the only company looking at doing this. According to one database I found, there are 19 separate constellations that are proposed, which would bring, if they're all approved and they all go through and do what they're planning, would put the number of satellites in orbit over 500,000.
Right. How big are these satellites?
So the Starlink ones in particular are, they're pretty big, actually. According to the Starlink website itself, they are 2.8 meters by 1.4 meters for the satellite body itself. So that's, you know, car-sized-ish. But then once they're up there, they extend a solar panel to provide power, and that adds another 8 meters.
What about the size of this new Blue Walker satellite? Tell us about that.
So the Blue Walker 3 has an area of 64 square meters, which is about a third the size of a tennis court. So it's pretty big, which means it's got that much more area to reflect light. They have one or two test satellites in orbit at the moment. And right now, those are the brightest objects in the sky when they are sunlit at night.
And those are also in near-Earth orbit. They're not far, far out there.
They're, again, in a relatively near-Earth orbit. Near-Earth orbit is easy to get to because you don't have to go quite as high. So a lot of things go in near-Earth orbit.
Okay, let's talk about the impact. I know I like looking at the sky at night. I see satellites all the time now. What effects will the average person notice? Like, so what will it look like in the night sky?
We're at about the worst place. The effects are supposed to peak at around 50 degrees latitude north and south of the equator. So we're in that region where you're most likely to see satellites. They're going to be predominantly at dusk or dawn when the sun is still sort of just below the horizon, because you only see the reflected sunlight off of them. So the closer to dawn and dusk, the more likely you are to see that reflection and see the satellite itself. But you see them moving across the sky. Like you said, you know, almost every night now you go out and there's multiple satellites. And it's a big change. Back in 2016, there were about 1,000 active satellites. And I can remember being at a party with a bunch of astronomers and somebody got a notice on their phone that there was, they had an app or something, that there was going to be an iridium flare, which was, we would be able to see one of the iridium satellites pass overhead. And we all trooped outside because seeing a satellite pass overhead was kind of cool. It was a rare occurrence.
In 2017.
In 2017. And then in 2019, Starlink started launching. And now when I go out stargazing with student groups or public events, I can stand there and I can watch. There's a satellite. There's a satellite. There's a satellite. And I'll see four or five in the space of 10 minutes.
Yeah. What do you, I mean, will we get a night sky that looks just sort of like a traffic jam situation with just lights going, just sort of man-made objects in the sky instead of the stars? That
We could. I saw one estimate that in the not too distant future, one in 15 points of light in the sky could be a satellite rather than a star if you go out to a dark spot. There's also worry, you know, you see this one point, but there's also a lot of reflected scattered light that's not coming from a particular point. And there's some estimates that having these satellite constellations out there reflecting light back to Earth is going to make the night sky 2 to 3 times brighter than it already is. And that's not something that you can get away from. Like right now, if you want to go stargazing and you live in a town, or like even in Sackville, the skies are not that dark. But you know, you can go out to your camp or your cabin. You can go to Fundy or Kushbushuak, and those are dark sky preserves. And so you can get really good views of the night sky. But if we have these satellite constellations producing all this light pollution, you can't get away from that.
And so for, you know, for the average person with the naked eye, that's one thing. Now, for astronomers, it's even worse, the problem.
It's a disaster.
Right.
The ground-based telescopes are most often either radio telescopes or optical telescopes, because those are the wavelengths that can get through the atmosphere most easily. And both of those encounter problems from the Starlink satellites that are up there now, and the problem is only going to get worse. With the optical images, we see streaks as the satellites move across our field of view, and that makes it very hard to detect objects. If you're looking for near-Earth asteroids, you want warning that some object is going to hit us. That's the kind of project that is really impacted by these satellites, because you almost can't do that kind of observation where you're looking for faint objects moving through your field of view. So that's one problem. Transient phenomenon are another problem. We're often in astronomy looking for things that happen very quickly. And so if you have a couple of frames of data that are lost because of a satellite passing through, you may miss the event entirely. And then in radio, we have the communications blocking certain wave bands. I was looking at images this morning that showed two adjoining bands, and in one, it's a beautiful, clear image of this object, and there's no noise whatsoever. And then in the neighboring band, it's the same wavelength as the Starlink communication, and you can't see anything. It's just all noise.
We can't see, you know, how these communications devices affect each other, but like this is, yeah, the unseen consequences here.
Yeah, yeah. And right now for ground-based astronomy in the radio, the telescopes are often built in designated quiet zones where, you know, you're not allowed to have a cell phone, you're not allowed to have a microwave. So to try and really limit the radio pollution. But if it's coming from space, from the orbit, near-Earth orbit, you can't do that.
Now, I have heard some people say, well, we mean we have space telescopes now, like that we don't really need to worry about ground-based. But there's a lot of ground-based telescopes and a lot of astronomy happens.
A lot of astronomy happens from the ground. And this isn't a problem that is not affecting space telescopes. Even Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, often sees satellites passing through its field of view because it's at a slightly lower orbit than some of these constellations. But there's a lot that you can only do from the ground, or that you can do better from the ground. You know, there's, you know, 50 odd telescope sites around the world where we have major observatories. and that's an observatory where there might be three or four different telescopes, and those, you know, we can't afford to put that many objects out at L1 where James Webb is, and James Webb is oversubscribed by an enormous factor. It's, you know, four or five times at least as much people are applying for time as there is time to give. Mm-hmm. And so if we only have these very expensive elite space observatories, we're not going to be able to do a lot of astronomy.
I mean, I know you've written this letter. I'm sure other astronomers have also written to the FCC about this. It really sounds like an international problem. But I mean, you're talking to the U.S. government here about this, and what are you hoping they'll do?
I'm hoping that they'll come up with some way of regulating satellites and say, you know, it seems like space seems really big. It is really big, but near Earth orbit is a really small space, and so we need to have some way of controlling what goes on there. And it's not just the FCC. We can do the same thing here in Canada. We can advocate for regulation of satellites. The other thing that listeners can do if they feel passionate about this issue, as well as advocating for regulation, you can push governments to expand rural broadband networks so that people don't have to go with satellite internet. If there's no money to be made, they won't put the satellites up there.
Right. So we can do our, you know, the old-fashioned terrestrial style broadband internet. We don't like, and so avoid the problem of going to satellites.
Yes. And if we do want to do satellites, I was reading there's ways around it. If you think about the GPS satellites, the GPS satellites are in what we call a geosynchronous orbit. So they're stationary over a single point on the Earth. And you can get GPS coverage pretty much anywhere. And there's, you know, 40 or 50 GPS satellites. So if we really do think satellite internet is the way to go, then maybe what we should look at is having larger telescopes or larger satellites, more powerful satellites, higher up. If we put them at 6,000 kilometers, we would need maybe a 10,000th the number of satellites that we have, that we need now in low Earth orbit. They would be in a more stable orbit, so we wouldn't have potential pollution problems with them coming back. That's something I didn't talk about. The Starlink satellites are predicted to have a lifespan of 5 years, which means every 5 years they need to replace them. That means that they're constantly launching new ones, and they are expected to what we call deorbit the satellites every at the rate of about 25 a day once the full constellation is up. It's a hard problem, and you know, this is something that we need to figure out. And I know people in rural areas need internet, and having great cell phone coverage is also really important for a lot of people. But we need to find a way to balance those needs with our culture, our heritage. You know, the dark sky is recognized by UNESCO as part of our world heritage, and we need to keep that.
If people are interested in this, what do you recommend that the layperson does?
Talk to your local representatives and, as, like I said, advocate for for satellite regulation, advocate for broadband expansion. If you can possibly avoid it, don't use Starlink. those are the big things. And just keep yourself informed of the issue.
That's Catherine Lovkin, astronomer and professor at Mount Allison University in Sackville. Lovkin has written to the U.S. Federal Communications Commission expressing concern over the impact of near-Earth satellites on the night sky and the ability of astronomers to study it. To see a visualization of the satellites surrounding the planet in near-Earth orbit, check out satellitemap.space. You can check out chmafm.com later today for the full interview with Catherine Lovkin.
This is Erica Butler reporting for CHMA Sackville and the Local Journalism Initiative.
From music composition to the soundscapes of our built and natural environments, the study of sound can be approached from many perspectives. The Faculty of Communication, Art and Technology offers courses in sound in each of these three schools. Open to any undergraduate student interested in studying sound, the new Certificate in Sound offers the opportunity to gain recognition for a broad study of sound across a variety of disciplines. Talk to your advisor or visit FCAT's website for more details about the certificate.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz.
I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for No Holds Barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.